intros have been unsuitable for some time.
But if you'll just give me one more chair.
I'm sorry. There's only so much we can do with your alcoholic shtick. In fact, I'm now thinking we should take a cue from the blogosphere and scrap this project altogether. The same way the Lit Blog Co-op was killed. After all, it just takes too much time. And you were the one to call them Bolsheviks.
But I haven't even told them my entire backstory.
Tell that to Marsha Klimaszewski.
And thank you all for coming. And Marshall, it's a pleasure to finally meet you tonight.
Yeah, it's my pleasure as well.
Yeah, well, first off, I actually wanted to ask you about the nature of these stories, sort of a general question. Many of these stories are very much about the story behind the story, and particularly the third house, which I know you're going to read from tonight. Mm. So I wanted to ask you, on a general level, what kind of planning you do for these rather embedded and labyrinthine at times stories that you do.
To a certain extent, I don't know that I particularly plan them in advance so much as it has seemed like a sort of natural thing that the influence for the story for a book will be prior books as much as it will be life experience of any kind. And in certain stories that was more prominently true in a way that I wanted to make explicit as part of the story, like The Third House with James and some other authors. And then I guess with the historical fiction, there's something, you know, a bit more obvious in that way in terms of just the research and that goes into them along the way.
I want to ask you about the historical fiction. Are you sort of a historical junkie? Is this why you dwell on them? There are three stories in this that are related and rooted, actually, in historical characters. So maybe you can talk about what distinguishes these. And in fact, they deal with fascism, Stalinism. I'm getting a sort of social construct theme going on with this. So I'm wondering as to what causes you to submerge yourself into a historical period. Is it exploring a cultural construct? Because you see this a lot in your contemporary stories as well.
Mm. You know, I think it was two different things on two different levels. As a writer, it just became really interesting to me to have a more coherent prior text like that to be writing my way into, and to feel that the story was from the beginning a kind of braided cord or something rather than a sort of single strand of narrative, that there was both the actual events and then what I would sort of do with them or how I might navigate through them. In each of the case of these three stories, there was also just something about that I read about the particular events and the circumstances that they're about that just captured my interest in a very writerly way. I think it's not untypical, but they're all kind of written into those intriguing holes in the historical fabric that seem to present themselves as a possibility for fiction.
But Nobile's Airship and also Aeronauts deal not only with flight, but also the North Pole. So I'm getting a sort of kind of a natural gravitation towards ballooning and airships and the like, and I'm wondering why this appeals to you. I mean, it kind of is reminiscent in some degree of the ultimate fight or flight. If you're going to choose the latter option, but you're going to go to the most extreme ends of the earth. I'm wondering what motivates that.
One led to the other. Nobile's Airship is about this Italian expedition in 1929 to attempt to get to the North Pole in an airship. It was actually the second trip to the North Pole in an airship, but this time it was by the same guy, by this Nobile, an Italian captain and airship designer. And the first time he had gone under Amundsen, and it had been a Norwegian expedition, and he had just sort of been the pilot. This time the airship was called the Italia. It was very much an Italian and for a while a sort of Mussolini-backed expedition. But it ended in tragedy, and to a certain extent sort of, I think, contributed to both the closing down of the great period of polar exploration and also the end of airships. And I got interested in it when I read just a New York Times article. There was a new article, new at the time, which is probably six, 7 years ago or something like that, but some new research suggesting, casting more doubt on the claims of Byrd and Perry ever having reached the pole. And they were saying that that meant that the first people to actually reach the pole were Nobile and Amundsen in this airship. And then at the very end of it, it sort of said, and Nobile went back, it was just a couple of paragraphs, Nobile went back a number of years later, successfully reached the pole, but on the return trip, the ship crashed, and it described how the bottom of the airship, the sort of whole control structure and the thing that kind of provided most of the weight, sheared away from the actual balloon part of it, and the balloon part with several crew members on board sort of floated away and sort of disappeared into the mist, never to be seen again. And that image was what just sort of attracted me and seemed just really sort of strangely akin to the what was about to happen to airships in general, to polar travel, to the way that the pole itself would sort of recede into the mist. Yeah. So,
but all of your characters in many of these stories are very, they live rudderless existences. They're, in fact, there's one thing I wanted to ask you about, as a balding man myself, they tend to have thinning hair, and so I have to ask you, in fact, you know, there's a lot of hair motif throughout this. You describe the rustles of Stalin's mustache. You actually, at one point, have a piano player who has his gray-bearded head pops out of nowhere, and so there's this sense of hair as a kind of motif of wisdom and possibly folly, and in fact, you know, there's a sort of almost character who seems vaguely reminiscent of you, who has red hair, who I must ask you about, who forms the basis of two stories. So what's with the hair? I mean, you know, how's your hair doing these days?
You know, I must admit this is news to me. I hadn't realized I was writing so much about hair. Although, recently, the last story in the collection, Aeronauts, is also about a polar expedition a little bit earlier. It's set in the 1890s. And if I could have published that story in any way possible, I would have published it with some photos from the expedition. And recently, last week, I did a reading in St. Louis, where I live, in which it's a story in multiple voices. It's kind of a collage narrative. And with the help of a couple of friends reading different parts, we put it together. But we also used a slideshow of some of these photos. And that was the first time I was realizing that absolutely everybody in the slideshow had a great deal of hair on their face and very little on their head. And, actually, yeah, a motif that I have just recently started to recognize. But it was not...
It's very much there. I kept paying attention to the hair. Yeah, trust me. Trust me. Lots of hair. I mean, it's a good thing. Don't get me wrong.
Okay.
Speaking of perspective, I actually wanted to ask you about the fact that you write mostly in the third person, but in the case of Tyrants and Junhee, you actually use first person, but you don't actually write in the form of a man. You write in the form of a woman. Mm-hmm. So I'm wondering, are you hesitant to write in first person man, male?
Those are the only two first person stories?
Yeah, and they're women. I mean, so I'm wondering if you think that's just too, it's not enough of a literary challenge for you to write just from an innate gender perspective?
No. I don't know. I think point of view seems to me like such it's a really important element of craft, but at the same time, something that grows out of the you know, perceived needs early on in the composition of a story. So I never recognized that or thought about that strategically in any way. I'm somewhat self-conscious about the fact that there are a couple of narratives that are narrated by women, and I always sort of feel like that's a somewhat problematic sort of thing. That sort of crossing certain, you know, significant demographic sort of barriers. But it's something that I keep finding myself sort of interested in attempting at the same time. And I suppose to a certain extent that's an outgrowth of what attracts me as a reader to literature, is the attempt to sort of cross those boundaries and to understand another mind.
But you're also tackling something that's very difficult to write about in Junhee, with the whole pregnancy issue and all that. And that's why I'm asking if this is kind of a challenge for you to get inside a perspective that, I mean, what did you do that? Did you ask your wife or other women how they felt? Because you really kind of get a sense of what it's like to have that decision laid in on your shoulders and in your stomach in this case.
Well, I mean, I hope it's authentic enough to be convincing or worthwhile for a reader. And to a certain extent, yeah, I think in any of those cases involved speaking to and drawing from the experience of trusted friends, of people I was close to, But I also just think that that sort of fictional authenticity is a kind of, you know, strange, dubious substance anyway. I mean,
in what sense?
Well, you're trying to write sort of towards some kind of emotional truth, but through following the logic of a bunch of lies, you know. And there is that strange way in which, especially in a short story, much more than a novel, authenticity can be, I think sometimes at least, successfully suggested with so little. You know, it's a few strokes here and a few strokes there, and hopefully if they don't appear to have been manipulated, and if they feel as though they sort of connect to other things in the story, there's that weird way in which as a reader I find that, you know, a sense of depth of field emerges, and you feel as though you are with somebody who knows what they're talking about. But you know, there are certain stories in this book where I don't know what I'm talking about, you know, even 2 feet beyond what's on the page.
I'm wondering what the relationship is between personal experience, or drawing from personal experience, and then just this imagination, just being an outright fabricator, a liar, a prevaricator. Mm.
I think because I have only successfully really written about the other in various forms rather than about the self, although I've tried both, I am always particularly conscious of fiction is lying, but I don't know. It's fun too.
Yeah, it is fun to lie.
Yeah, it is.
Should we trust you? Actually, I had a very bizarre question. I always have bizarre questions, but I wanted to ask you about the stark modernist buildings and objects that one finds throughout this collection. In Junhee, you describe a church as a new squat building with white aluminum siding and very few windows, industrial strength religion. The only sign of holiness from the outside was a small golden cross perched at the front, crowned like a weather vane. Now, in some thrills, you describe an Austin Healey that is of the pewter shade, particular to roadsters in the bullet race cars of the early 60s, flecked and textured, a color as vivid in black and white films. And then, in The Last Time I Saw Richard, you even describe Emily as wearing blouses exhausting the cement spectrum. So I'm getting a sort of Gruppo 7 brutalist feel to this, and I have to ask you how these decisions come about. I mean, is this the kind of landscape that these characters, who are often stuck in some sense, they need to have this kind of cement-like, stark, kind of really almost spear-like environment to wander in? Or what's the deal here?
I mean, that's interesting. The real answer is that, you know, I know that Austin Healey, and I know those blouses, and and I know that, what was the first one?
It was the church.
Yeah, I know that church, actually,
only having
too.
One indicator, the cross. Yeah.
But I think, there is a way in which I suppose it's a sort of wintry book. Then there are the polar expeditions as well, and a whole lot of white and grayscale in those too, I suppose, that one could add. And I think there was a certain way in which, once I started to think about it as a book, and started to see the ways in which the stories might speak to one another, that became interesting to me.
Mm. So basically, really, it was the winter that kind of encouraged this monochromatic look.
And
did you
true.
Dwell on brutalist architecture in any sense? I'm just really curious. I just got that vibe.
Yeah, I didn't. I mean, now I will. But I didn't.
Speaking of fire and winter, I have to ask you about the fire metaphors in this. I mean, many of these stories are rooted in marriages, and in fact, you replace the marital hearth at one point with a malfunctioning SCR pack on a Bromberg furnace, and that's in the Tanner and Junhee. So I'm getting a sort of 20th century technological influence, almost as if the tradition is being corrupted in some sense by the emergence of technology. And I was wondering if you can comment upon this. There's a malfunctioning here in another story, but unfortunately I don't have it written down, but I did notice that.
Mm. You know, I didn't think of it in connection to fire, although I do think maybe to a certain extent every writer, maybe this isn't true, maybe it's only me, but I feel that my home cliche, the one I am the sucker for, is, you know, has to do with a crackling fire in a fireplace in some way. But in other stories, and particularly in the airship and then the ballooning story, I was really interested in times and places and sort of sets of circumstances in which the what is thought at the moment to be technologically cutting edge and something quite carefully engineered almost immediately becomes something that we think of as romantic and as at the sort of other end of that, poetic in some way. And the sort of technological falling into the space of image is something that, that I feel it really happened with airships at the time that this is set, and then with the hydrogen balloon in Andre's stories as well. So maybe that would be interesting.
Well, I mean, I'm wondering though, because we're dealing with a very 20th century symbol, and we're also dealing with again fascism and Stalinism. I'm tempted to and perhaps dangerously look upon these stories as reflective of some cultural construct that gets in the way of human emotions, that gets in the way of being able to survive in this world. Because in the first story, the Noble story, you actually have this character, his sense of entitlement is encouraged by the very fascism that actually occurs. And I mean, you know, he's wandering around, and instead of being able to cope with this failed relationship, he becomes very much a part of a really incorrigible part of this particular system.
I mean, that's a big question. It's not. It doesn't happen to be one of those sort of areas that I, again, you know, was consciously aiming for. But it's really interesting as you sort of draw it out. I guess I think that again might come back to that same sort of thing, that there may be a certain way in which I was interested in obsolescence and in the way in which when some of these things become obsolete, that they do so in ways that to a later viewer may be quite pretty. The nature of an airship, for instance, and for the people involved, you know, it's kind of a crisis. It has to do with finding yourself no longer living in the time in which you. In which you belong, or something. So I suppose that would connect to that.
Well, I'll give you one more sort of thing I observed to support this rather cockamamie theory of mine. But I wanted to ask you about the penchant for wood throughout these stories. In the Noble story, you have a polar bear with the pulped pages of the crew's navigational books in its stomach. So it's something that comes directly from trees. In the third house, you have a table that's laid with newsprint. So you have something that's taken from trees and then something layered over with trees. In fact, in that story as well, you have limbs described. You have the one character, and I can't remember exactly what it is, but you describe the limbs very much like a tree. And then, of course, in Tanner, you have a card table, which is the thinnest possible thing you could probably get from wood. So I have to ask, this sort of suggests, again, this taking from the environment, using the technology, and that this kind of is as much of a problem or as much of an obstacle as an image, as there, you know, and that it's almost sort of this obstacle, this obstruction that they, you know, maybe you can sort of talk about this idea.
I feel I'm coming to understand my book the more you talk. Pretty soon I'll really know what I wrote. It's not something I thought about. But it's interesting. I mean, I suppose several of those passages you're citing are as much about pages, and that was something I thought about. As you started with that, it might be a book that would have other books in it and behind it, and more explicitly as progenitors in some way, and allowed to sort of make their way among the people as well. But then transferring those into tables, I didn't even think about. But it's really interesting to me.
I'm wondering if...
I like wood. I do like wood.
Are you surrounded by trees? I mean, you go for lots of walks in the woods?
I like trees. I really like trees.
Okay. But forget the theory. Actually, I also wanted to ask you about a very curious image that crops up in two of your stories, in Some Thrills in the Third House, and it's so unusual, and it's not the same character, because I checked, and I had to read it twice just to make sure that my... completely freaking out here, but you actually have a woman who has muscular forearms rowing for a crew team, and then fond of wearing sleeveless jerseys in Some Thrills in the Third House. And this is a very curious image. I mean, you know, I have to ask you about it. I mean, there's certainly many things I could probably sort of suggest about this image, but maybe I want to hear about what is it about this image that you felt the need to kind of put it into two stories.
Oh, God, I don't know. I mean, I didn't... I didn't realize it was in two different stories to tell you.
I mean, it's a very interesting image.
Yeah, that's interesting. The I don't know if they're both connected to Henry. Those are both Henry stories. Yeah. I do think of him as a character who just has a you know, is part of what he's going through is a relatively conventional attachment to and feeling of losing youth, and I suppose well-defined forearms might contribute to that, sort of sense of that in some way. But I honestly don't
well, there's
know.
There's almost a sort of, I mean, in his relationship with Mr. Jones, there's this kind of sense of there's a vaguely, you know, homoerotic thing possibly going on. Mm. There's also a sort of he feels kind of threatened by this possible sort of potential wife of his. And in fact, while we're on the subject, I mean, we haven't even really talked about the notion of marriages, that you kind of a lot of these stories really just emerge from the fascinating relationships that these characters have. And the thing is if they're not married, they are really planning very hard to be married. I mean, you know, there's the whole the turkey baster alternative in one story, which I mean, you know, very, very peculiar language of but also pragmatic in some sense. And so I wanted to ask you about the kind of pragmatic nature of marriage in this, and why everything sort of seems to emerge from these particular sort of marriages of people who are roughly around 30. And who?
Well, I mean, I realized it would be at some point along the way that it would be a book that would be about to a certain extent about these the odd intersections of these two different kinds of love, parental love and passionate love, and for instance, you're saying, you know, a touch of something perhaps homoerotic between Henry and Mr. Jones from this story that I'll read a little bit of later. I never thought of it quite that way, but I absolutely can see what you mean. And there's this way in which I think of it instead as actually just that weird space that we don't talk about too much, and I suppose it touches on certain taboos of where love for a parent, and having relatively recently become a parent myself, I know this runs in the other ways as well, can sometimes, it's my experience at least, and maybe I should you know, seek professional help for this, but that it can weirdly sort of resemble romantic love or passionate love, in the way that never involves sex, and that immediately makes it feel as though then it's not resembling it. Then there the resemblance is absolutely gone. But I think that's not quite true to my experience, at least, that there's an odd way in which there's something that some interesting overlap there of just sort of depth of attachment that I was interested in. And so I know that that's something that, you know, ties several of the stories together, I think.
Maybe what you're dealing with here is pursuing a taboo like this of how you express your affection or your companionship for another person. And it's coded in this rather inexpressive prose sometimes, in the sense that these people are stalled. And maybe that's possibly why I kind of made this inference. And I'm wondering, in terms of, you know, continuing to sort of explore this, is, I suppose, there a danger in having someone view this the wrong way? Because it is a gamble to really sort of ride the inexpressive nature of the prose like this, I think.
Yeah, I mean, to a certain extent, right, any book that's going to be about marriages, if it's fiction, has to be mostly about bad marriages, right? Yeah. Because that's the stuff of drama, I suppose. But they're not all bad in this book, and I think there is that way in which there are at least some of the characters in it who are still at the point of attempting to feel that they can successfully communicate and successfully be as close as they once were or wish to be, and so there is that communication that is perhaps primarily attempt and only secondarily and in moments of things coming together, success, you know. So the inarticulate becomes important there, I would suppose.
I'm also curious why you're drawn more towards small towns and bucolic locations over metropolises. Do you think, I mean, this is also another sort of going back to our wood motif earlier. I'm wondering if something happens in the country in terms of this kind of inexpressive emotion that you feel happens more in rural areas as opposed to urban areas.
I don't necessarily think that, or don't know if that's true. I think some of these stories are written, there are these two sets of three stories, and those just happen to be written in and around the area where I grew up, in relatively rural Connecticut, although a Connecticut that was still only 2 hours away from here. And so it's about that place and that milieu and some of the things that I think do come out of that place that have to do with second homes and being a local and versus being a New Yorker living in a second home there. All of that is something that gets into the book just because it's part of my experience. Gotcha. But I didn't consciously think that there was some way, but it may be true. I don't know. I'd have to think about that there is some way in which some of those things, are going to thrive there as opposed to in a city. I'm not sure.
Okay. One last question, then we'll have you read from the third house. And I actually wanted to ask you in relation to what we were talking about in terms of personal experience. There are a lot of literary references throughout these stories. I mean, very specific ones. I mean, there are the Falks in The Last Time I Saw Richard. In the third house, which you're going to read from, Mr. Jones is writing a book on James. We don't know if it's Henry, but Henry is the name of the character, so that was quite interesting. And then in some thrills, you even evoke Bartleby at one point by pointing out that Henry would prefer not to, which I found quite interesting. So I'm wondering if these are helpful reference points for you, or whether this is kind of a way for you to sort of, well, this is my way of fitting in the literary canon. I don't know.
No, I mean, I think probably any writer sort of makes literary references cautiously, or it's hard not to feel that there could be something a little smarmy or strange about doing that. But there was that way in which the books leading to other books and books shaping the narratives as much as and the characters' relationships to books within the story shaping the narrative as much as their experiences with one another was something that I became quite interested in with the book. So that would be part of why those would be in there.
There's something Homeric about it. You want to sort of tie it into the great web, or is this a way of kind of acknowledging your books as friends?
I just had this feeling of at times at least of I mean, I think anything one writes, probably for most writers, certainly for me, is rising out of what you've been reading to a certain extent, and it's a writer's food, of course, and food for the material. But there were times where in this collection where it just felt like it was feasible and would be interesting, would be appealing to me, and just sort of playing around at the desk to make that process be allowed to get onto the page and to sort of work into the characters' lives as well to a certain extent.
Gotcha. Well, with that in mind, we should probably let the audience know what we're talking about here. And so maybe you could read The Third House and let people know about this
stuff. I'd be happy to. I'm just going to read the first seven pages of this story. It'll probably be about 15 minutes or so. It's the first of three stories that are interlinked. They sort of transfer their attention gradually from the father, Henry, who is the main character in this story, to his son, Brian. And I think the only thing I need to tell you is that there are two quotes from Henry James novels in these pages I'm going to read. They're a little bit more clearly marked off if you're seeing the page with the italics. I'll just try to read them in a slightly different voice. The Third House. Angela's family owned three houses. Henry fell quickly in love with her. Her father was well-funded, inheritably and otherwise, and engaged in writing a book. These were Angela's self-conscious phrases. She referred to her father as Mr. Jones. What does he do? Henry had asked, and she had said, Mr. Jones is engaged in writing a book, Henry. Henry heard the irony, but chose to overlook it. Mrs. Jones was a lawyer who couldn't work due to illness, and Angela's two elder brothers had died in a sailing accident. It was too much, really, too picturesque and romantically misfortunate, yet all apparently true. Drowned but not forgotten, Angela said of her brothers. Henry had no idea how to interpret her tone there. She was 20, 6 years younger than Henry, but it didn't show. She attended the college where Henry sadly cut the grass. He was sitting in on classes also through the film department, and he worked for an ad agency in the city, but it didn't pay. She rode for the crew team and wore her sleeveless jerseys on her way, of course she did, back from the river or to class or the library, and then to bed with him too when he asked. The muscles of her upper arms were long and glossy. Her habitual expression was a willing and absorbed smile, which seemed at first to be, pardon me, to soften the bite of her irony, but was in fact its most articulate feature. Henry had been in love before, you could say continuously since adolescence, but never so decisively or with so little encouragement. She accepted his romantic attentions without especially answering them. She seemed, he thought, hesitant to decline what was her due, although she might have been just as happy to leave these pennies in the till. One weekend she took him home to her family, apparently for the lark in it. "Mr. Jones will be fascinated," she said. "Be sure to wear this shirt." The first house was in the woods in the best part of the state, with the trees bare much of the year and beautiful nonetheless. Even the trunks and crowns of Connecticut were not created equal. They were knobbed creatures, congested and dismal to the north and east, hung with clothes or composed in clumps and rags between highways. But as one traveled south and west toward the shore and the city, they gained balance, solemnity, and a winter sophistication which might evoke, or in Henry's case instill, childhood memories in black and gray, punched up by a touch of limbed menace. Angela's father had had this house built to his specifications. It was low and horizontal, discreet in front with deep eaves. In back, there were tall windows conveying panels of landscape. It was fitted to the slope, unless the hillside had been sloped to fit. The leaves from the trees had recently fallen and were still bright. In the room where Angela's father sat, whichever it might be, there was a fire laid and moaning. The books had exploded from the shelves and settled on every surface like a pollen. They were damp on the edge of the tub and redolent beside the coffee maker, hardbacks in drab cloth or older paperbacks with out-of-fashion covers, well-handled but cared for, not shabby yet, incredibly inviting. All weekend they slipped into Henry's hands. He flipped the pages, read a line or a paragraph, and everything he read seemed apt, appropriate to the Joneses or their house or both. The large, low rooms with brown ceilings and dusky corners, this was James, the deep embrasures and curious casements, the quiet light on dark polished panels, the deep greenness outside that seemed always peeping in, the sense of well-ordered privacy in the center of a property. They smelled good, these books, or not good in the right way. Mr. Jones's book would be a study of James, a broad perusal through some narrow linguistic aperture which he politely declined to explain. It was a dilettante's occupation, he said, a way to pass the time. He said so with a quick and clipped delivery that served modesty with beautiful rigor. He had taught once at the same college that Angela attended, but he didn't any longer. He didn't work. He was engaged in writing a book. In the mornings, he bustled forth from the mysterious back of the house, the region where Angela's mother lay, Henry had yet to be introduced, to prepare the first stages of a breakfast that would linger until noon. Black coffee for his wife and for Henry, tea for himself, pills and vitamins, oranges cut for the juicer. The table was laid with newsprint, the Times and the New York Review of Books and the Guardian a day late from London. Angela was studying in her room. Mr. Jones took coffee back to his wife. Then he sat with Henry and they read together. He had halved lenses and his thinned hair was as the bed had left it. He was solicitous to Henry, but abstracted. He didn't seem to dislike him or to be fascinated. He seemed not the slightest bit altered or disturbed by the company, which made Henry feel comfortable and welcomed, even if it was merely negligence. His small talk was professorial to Henry's ear, gracious and well-crafted, though his flat and dampened voice may have been most responsible for the effect. It leveled sentences into thick, sad slabs. He said, "I'm making toast here, Henry, and we have some apple butter. Will you join me?" But it was as if he had said, "My son's died young, Henry, and my wife is an invalid. Can you imagine?" Around noon, he always sat back and sighed and said, "Well," there was a breathy H sound coupled to the W. He clapped his palms flat in his pants, a wonderfully decisive, preparatory gesture. Then he returned to the back of the house. Angela would emerge, sour and sharpened from concentration. She wanted to know how breakfast had gone. She wanted to know what they'd discussed. "Don't imagine he likes you," she said, and ate a crust of toast from her father's plate. "He does, though," Henry told her. "He says he digs me." She rubbed at one eye behind her glasses and scanned the articles her father had left exposed. "You think so?" Henry, he said, I'll speak plainly. I dig you. I'd like you to have my daughter. She said, we'll see, grinning only a little. She seemed truly disappointed, as if she'd left them alone together, hoping for the worst. Despite her remorselessly lovely face, Angela's hair was kinky and unruly. She failed to wash it or comb it as often as most other girls her age, and she napped at the drop of a hat, so that it often trailed her like someone else's prank. She was cynical about even cynics, and could never be surprised, yet it was a comfort to feel that she should probably consult a mirror more often than she did. Henry wondered how long his novelty might last. He said, anyway, we don't need you, Mr. Jones and I. We don't need your approval, you know. We'll elope if we have to. When she ignored the joke, he unsuccessfully resolved never to tell her another again. For the week surrounding Thanksgiving, she invited him to house number 2. It was a cottage in Maine. There were as many books here, predominantly about sea voyages and polar expeditions, with maps inside the covers. There were fires burning in 2 rooms. A fire here was to dry the damp from your clothes and bake the salt into your skin. The pages of the books were often salty. The floors had warped so that they creaked or groaned in poignant, leathery phrases. Angela spent the better part of each day upstairs with her studies while Henry was downstairs with Mr. Jones. She had chosen chemical engineering, a discipline of great mystery without the slightest intrigue for Henry, as it was for her father. And though she could seldom get through half a chapter of a novel before falling asleep, she never dozed in front of her glossy, congested pages on thermodynamics and the principles of mass transport. Had Henry been invited to the house to keep her father company? Maybe the invitation had been his idea. Henry listened to Angela's pacing from the room below, and sometimes he heard her mother as well, coughing or moving about at the farther end of the house. He still hadn't been introduced to Mrs. Jones, hadn't set eyes on her, in fact, and neither Angela nor her father had bothered to apologize for this or make an excuse. Mr. Jones would stop reading when they heard his wife stir, although he kept his head still, and you could only tell by the way the focus strained from his eyes. Mr. Jones didn't fish himself, but he would walk down the hill before dark, in no hurry, though it was always raining on this visit to Maine, to buy a good fish from the boats coming back. Angela would undress Henry while they watched Mr. Jones through the window and listened for her mother. They left their shirts on, but took the time to remove shoes. It was too disgraceful to stumble about with your pants bunched at your ankles. At least to Henry it was, probably not to Angela. He stood behind her and they watched her father's orange parka slip down through the break in the hedge. And then, in the reflection on the surface of the window, he saw her close her eyes and smile. She was a person who smiled when she was angry, Henry had learned. What he had taken for lust initially, he recognized as anger now, though he didn't know exactly who or what she was angry at, and in certain ways he never would. When they were tired of standing, they lay on the warmed floor near the fire. The person on top watched for her father. She said he watched impatiently, but it wasn't quite true. It was enough when he was alone with her to know that her father would be there later as compensation when Angela had retreated again. Mr. Jones brought back a cod or a flounder. Lunches were haphazard. A crate of mangoes had been delivered through the mail, or there was soft cheese to spread, a ripe avocado without instructions. But Mr. Jones prepared elaborate dinners, Henry as his sous chef. Garlic and clarified butter and capers, ingredients unfamiliar to Henry or translated into unfamiliar states, or simply handled with an unfamiliar reverence that rendered even the garlic exotic. Some evenings Angela joined them, but never Mrs. Jones. There wasn't a Thanksgiving turkey or a mention of turkey or anything that could possibly be mistaken for a trimming. Henry lied about this to his parents on the telephone that evening. It would have further damaged the poor impression they had somehow formed already, though they hadn't met Angela or her parents. Did they feed you? His father asked first. Your mother cooked enough for a small army, he said. And what did they feed you? His mother wanted to know. Who are these people was what they meant, of course. Can we trust them? There was a sound of machinery beside his mother, and the television turned up to overcome it. She was vacuuming while she talked. There had been an accident involving a cousin and cranberry sauce. Put Mr. Jones on for a sec, she shouted. Henry told her, no, he's out chopping wood, which was true. It was why he had chosen this moment to call. He stood in the far corner of the dining room, facing the windows, the spot in the house farthest from Mrs. Jones's room, but he had to shout, and the house was silent. He would certainly be heard. He wondered now just how quiet he and Angela had been together in the same room earlier that afternoon. He watched Mr. Jones swing an axe sadly in the majestic drizzle. "I'll tell him you said thanks," he said, and had to repeat himself. "I gotta go," his mother said, "but listen, get Angela to come here for Christmas, okay? I'll make a nice meal." Angela had taken cream of wheat and a rusty nail upstairs to her mother after dinner. Her father carried wood in before Henry could help, and together they rebuilt the fire in the parlor. He said, "Play some music if you like," when he and Henry were alone together. The neighbor's cat had followed him in and leapt up as soon as he formed a lap. The records were all of orchestras and their components, formal men not unlike Mr. Jones on the covers, involved in passionate or contemplative gestures, or bent over instruments that were strangely cluttered for the sounds they produced. Also women caught open-mouthed in song. They were people who lived in houses like these, whose evenings sounded this way and lingered like so. Henry knew it. They belonged. Everything in this house belonged. The characters in the books Henry took down from Mr. Jones's shelves belonged, too. It was a life from the right kind of book, the kind Henry had always loved, and by now he realized this was what had made it feel familiar, despite the total lack of resemblance to his own life or to any household he'd ever visited. In the books he loved, it was usually raining, or it was snowing, and precipitation was a virtue. It was poorly lit, and there was a chill to burn off and a fire to do it by. There was an overlay of loneliness or someone ill upstairs in a bed. There was a quiet history of disappointment or tragedy behind each scene, but attractive tragedy. There were affairs as well, of course. Her father's life, Henry read in one of these novels, her sister's, her own, that of her two lost brothers, the whole history of their house had the effect of some fine, florid, voluminous phrase, say even a musical, that dropped first into words and notes without sense, and then, hanging unfinished, into no words or any notes at all. Why should a set of people have been put in motion on such a scale and with such an air of being equipped for a profitable journey, only to break down without an accident, to stretch themselves in the wayside dust without a reason? When the music began, Mr. Jones said slyly, "You're a Bach fan," as though Henry had been holding out on him. "Who isn't?" Henry ventured.
Thanks. And to know the conclusion, buy the book. Are there any questions from anybody?
Oh, thank you. Thank you.
May I ask how you learned the craft of writing? Did you take classes or study in school or courses after?
I did. I actually went to two master's programs for creative writing because I went to the first one straight out of undergraduate. I had some very good teachers and took some classes. And then I went to an MFA program straight out of that. And then recognized several years later that I had been much too young to make very good use of that first one. And so then went back to another one. I went to a little one called Bowling Green in Ohio first, and then to Boston University. I loved being in MFA programs and being in workshops. I reached my limit, certainly, and I think every writer does. But I learned a great deal, and I feel that I learned it so much more quickly than I would have on my own. And I also acquired some, you know, fellow students whose work I really loved and who became trusted readers and who remain trusted readers who prove very valuable now as well. So it was a pretty traditional route, and I really do feel that I've learned the most just by reading. But the secondary way is certainly by going through programs, and it's part of why I teach in one is how much I liked my experience of them.
Are you teaching?
I teach at Washington University in St. Louis.
Mm-hmm. Any other questions? Aha.
Jessica. I read your previous book, The Cottagers, which I thought was amazing.
And thank you.
This story reminded me of that in some sort of mundane details. It's about these sort of sophisticated people in a country house and someone who's not of their world encountering them and sort of falling in love with their lifestyle. And I wonder if that's a theme that you find yourself drawn to, and is it about class, or is it just sort of throwing people somewhere out of their element that sort of brings out the truth about them, or and has that kind of evolved for you from the cottagers, or?
Sort of. I mean, it's really honestly that's where I do write about the self. I mean, none of these characters are people I really know, and at the same time, that realm of experience is very much the thing that I've written about that is closest to my own. The Cottagers is set on the West Coast on Vancouver Island in a small little town where my wife and I have spent some time. But when we spent time there, it was the first time in my life that I was a cottager and that I was on the other side of this equation that I had grown up on as the local. And this was in this small town outside of Litchfield in Connecticut, where, as I say, a lot of New Yorkers had second homes that they would come to over the summer and for weekends through the rest of the year as well. And, you know, like any locals community, like any community between sort of the locals and the others like that, there was this range of responses, and there were a lot of people who really resented the people who had second homes there. But I was very much, for some reason, on the other side of it. I thought they were wonderful, you know, and a lot more interesting than... And this story in particular was very directly written out of that that interest in their lives that I remember from when I was young and how different it was. And in fact, that scene of speaking to his mother on the telephone while the vacuuming is running and everything comes from something which is. I don't know if this has remained true. I sort of think it hasn't, maybe. But at that time, when I was growing up in the 70s in this place, the cottages that people would have would really be kind of shabby, you know? People, it seemed like a sort of the fashion to have a place that was fairly neglected and quite old often and would be allowed to just sort of be what it was. And I think that was perhaps part of the escape for some people. And I had one friend in particular who he and his family had an old, very beautiful, but kind of rundown farmhouse that was their second home there. And they would come as much as they could on weekends over the course of the year. It seemed so much like a different world than my own, but in my own backyard, in this weird way. I remember this one weekend in particular in which they were the Browns. Mr. Brown, he had several pastures, I suppose they had once been, that were sort of fenced in with very pretty old stone fences, and they had been allowed to just go to seed, go into sort of weed and wildflowers and I suppose some hay mixed in for years and years and years, and so it would grow quite tall. And he had a riding lawnmower, which was kind of an unusual indulgence back then, but he used it. He had no interest in a lawn. He used it in order to sort of cut these paths through the tall grass, and he wouldn't allow his son, Tim, who really wanted to, you know, get to cut the paths one day. It was totally his own indulgence. And then inside their house, also, there was like this real deficit of furniture. It was as though they had, you know, just moved there, maybe, or were only spending a few days there, but in fact, they had owned the place for years and years and years. And it was always kind of dusty, and, you know, you felt like if you tracked mud into the house this week and you went back a couple weeks later, it would be dried and still there, you know? And it was that sort of place. But it was, at the same time, the other side of that is that, you know, every Saturday, I think it's Saturdays where there's the radio broadcast of the Met from the opera, and they would listen, his parents would listen to that in their room, and we knew that we weren't allowed to disturb them during that, and the deal was that we could do whatever we wanted as long as nobody got killed and the house didn't burn down, but we weren't allowed to disturb them during the opera, and so the whole house would be sort of saturated with, because they would have this a kind of old bedside clock radio that couldn't quite take the volume they would play it at, but they would be playing the opera, it's that sort of volume, and it would be sort of through the house, and while we were allowed to sort of just run around in the corners. And I remembered this one particular day, I've always thought of it, in which I came home from having spent a sleepover night with my friend Tim. I was like 12 or 13 or something, and Mr. Brown dropped me off. Mr. Brown was great too. He had one of those really radical comb-overs. You know, when it fell down, as it often would over the weekends, because he would let it go too, it would just be way down here, and every once in a while it would sort of shift it up, and it would start falling, and you would see the progress. But
that explains the hair.
Yeah, finally. Yeah, that's true. Maybe it's Mr. Brown. Yeah. And he dropped me off in his red Volvo, of course, you know, and I sort of walked into my house in which I remember the television was blaring, my younger brother and sister were fighting over something and sort of yelling and screaming at each other. My mother was vacuuming, and the minute I walked in, the door started yelling at me about the chores I needed to do. And I remember having this profound sense of, oh, I want to be living their life, you know, I don't want to be living my life. And so I think I eventually got past that kind of yearning to a certain extent, although I suppose, well, yeah, but some of it anyway. But that's what I was writing that story out of. And to a certain extent, The Cottagers came out of finding myself on the other side of that equation and remembering various things about being a local. Sorry, that's a long answer.
Go for it. Any other questions? Or?
Just a few things. Thanks for the books, especially The Cottagers, which is great.
Oh, thank you.
Did you write the stories during the paper? Were you working on the novel first? I wanted to know about that, and I also just wanted to know, because you draw your characters so well, I wonder how you keep
thank
track.
You.
Do you have, is there a way to keep track of how you, characters that you're interested in writing about, or do you think about them?
Mm. To answer your first question, that is a slightly odd thing. This is really my first book, mostly. Most of it was written before the novel was written. That story I was just reading, a part of The Third House is written at about the same time, and then there's one more, Aeronauts, the last story in the book, that was written after the novel quite recently. But the rest of it is written before, and some of it quite a bit before, so it's one of those collections that is a bit of a, for me, has some history to it, you know, and sort of these different phases of my writing to a certain extent, or it seems that way to me. I don't know if it does to a reader. And then writing characters, I don't have a trick, and I wish I did. I have always been jealous of writers who keep journals or who take better notes than I do. I do a little bit of that, but so little that it's not a major way, sort of form of composition. I feel I'm very much an organic writer, that I write something in the way that something grows, and I don't really know very far in advance where I'm going, and what I write, I try to listen to what I've written and let it dictate what might come next in some way. But having said that, I feel like I have hardly ever had a story work. I mean, I think part of being an organic writer means that you start a lot of things that die, and I've certainly done a lot of that. I've hardly ever had a story work, or a story like that is in this book, that didn't have as one of its initial components a voice that is attached to character. And even in some of the third-person stories, I think that's still true, that there is a voice that some way feels akin to or as though it has begun to sort of suggest a lived life, a brain that's operating there. And so something about just the nature of language and of prose leading to an idea of a mind seems to me that...
You never write with, like, the end of the story in mind.
Pretty much. I think there's one story in the book, the title story, Tyrants, in which I knew the end and had written the end early. Unless I'm forgetting, I don't think any other I did.
Any other questions? Okay, well, I guess that's it. So
thank you all very much.
Thank you very much, Marshall. Thank you all.
Thank you.
Thank you.
If you catch me at the